Hey, hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And this episode with Mario Gibney is brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Bitcoiners, I'm so excited to tell you about Ledin.io. Ledin offers interest-bearing savings accounts and Bitcoin-backed loans with the best rates in the entire industry, enabling users to access dollars or additional Bitcoin without needing to sell your existing holdings. That's right, Ledin is bringing financial services to Bitcoin that enable you to use your BTC as pristine collateral. Already a Ledin client? Ledin wants you to get more for referring friends and family to Ledin. So as of December 1st, they're increasing their referral bonus to $50 in USDC for the rest of the year. That means you'll now get 50 USDC every time your unique referral link is used to open and fund a Ledin savings account. Since they wanted to make this a win-win, your referral will also receive 50 USDC. Best of all, listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast can get $50 in free USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. Learn more, sign up, and get earning at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. All right, I'm so pumped to tell you about the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Bitcoin 2021 was a smash hit success. Over 13,000 Bitcoiners came together to celebrate freedom, to celebrate Bitcoin, and the energy was absolutely electric. This year, the conference is going to be bigger and even better. The Bitcoin Magazine team is moving it over to the Miami Beach Convention Center, and there is going to be a massive four-day festival celebrating Bitcoin, bringing together the greatest minds in Bitcoin, the best businesses in Bitcoin, and the freshest and dopest art and culture in Bitcoin. Day one on April 6th of next year is Industry Day. You can buy a special ticket to mingle, make connections, and make business deals happen. On days two and three, April 7th and 8th, there is going to be a full-blown Bitcoin conference, the main event, if you will. Packed with the best speakers in the space, now including headliner Saifedean Ammous, who was on episode 84, where we discussed his new book, The Fiat Standard. And lastly, the Sound Money Music Festival on day four. Imagine going to Coachella, but for Bitcoin. There are going to be very few talks. It's going to be all about the culture of Bitcoin and hanging out with your fellow plebs. There's going to be Bitcoin musicians, Bitcoin artists, and your favorite Bitcoiners all in an amazing environment to party and just soak it all in and get people to realize that a Bitcoin world, a world where people are doing Bitcoin things, is the world that we all want to live in. That's what Bitcoin 2022 is all about. That's what the Bitcoin conference is all about. It's going to be a celebration of Bitcoin and the Bitcoiners and this amazing movement that is going to make the world a better place. Go to b.tc/conference and learn more about Bitcoin 2022, the amazing things that are happening in Miami and around the conference, and buy your tickets. And guess what? You can use the code BitcoinMatrix for 10% off at checkout. Go and do it today. Prices are only going to go up. This is going to be a can't-miss event. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix for this fantastic conversation with Mario Gibney about his early days at Blockstream, the benefits of the SegWit and Taproot upgrades to the Bitcoin network, and his favorite aspect of Bitcoin.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Mario Gibney is the director of community at Ledin. He was formerly at Blockstream, and he is also the co-host of the OnHashed podcast. Mario, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, man, this is great. I'm super excited. We've got to chat a little bit offline before on Google Meets, but it's great to have you on the show. And, you know, I think you've been around quite a while now in sort of the Bitcoin space. You were formerly at Blockstream. What exactly is your rabbit hole story?
I've cracked half a decade now. It would have been May 2016 was the first time I rolled up to a Bitcoin meetup, and I was pretty hooked from that point on.
Where was that?
That was in Seoul. I used to live in South Korea, so I spent most of my 20s as an English teacher in South Korea, and it was never like a career for me. It was just kind of I decided to take 1 year off, between or after I finished my undergrad. I had this plan to do academia. I studied classics university. I was going to do my master's, and I decided to take 1 year off and go teach English in Asia somewhere. And I ended up choosing Korea. So I went for 1 year, and then loved it. So I was like, I'll stick around for another year. I'll do another year, and then it just kind of became home. I ended up staying around 6 years in total. I guess it would have been 2015. I first heard of Bitcoin just from a friend at a bar. Was excited about this nerdy internet money thing, and it was the kind of thing I'd be interested in. I remember he kind of helped me install a mycelium wallet on my phone and sent me like a dollar or two, and then I kind of forgot about it. Like, I mean, I you know, occasionally checked into the subreddits at various points, but it wasn't until about a year after that that I had some extra time in my hands. I was like, yeah, maybe I should look into this Bitcoin thing again, and found an English speaking meetup like walking distance from my house, and so I rolled up and was pretty much hooked from the start. There's a really, really good group out there, which I think that the meetup has since been mothballed. The Seoul Bitcoin meetup was run by Ruben Thompson, who's become a very good friend of mine, and he had a really good group going there. We would meet about once a week in a cafe and just catch up on all the news and kind of help each other learn technical concepts, and it was a really I ran into someone, I was in El Salvador last week, who described it as a very scholarly meetup. And I was like, oh, that sounds very kind of distinguished. But it was in a lot of ways. Like, we spent, like, there wasn't a lot of kind of price talk. There wasn't a lot of, it wasn't like super casual in that, like, you would just roll up my beers, blah, 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 whatever. I mean, like, it was casual that anyone could show up and like, we would show up, be like, today we're going to learn, like, you know, learn about the UTXO set. Today we're going to learn how Lightning works. Today we're going to learn how, you know, like SegWit works. And it was a small group of us there ended up getting pretty into it from a technical level.
I got a couple questions there. Do you think you were in Korea, I guess, and do you think you would have went to a meetup like this if you were in your home country, or was a little bit of like, I want to meet people? And what were the other people there? Were they native to Korea? Were they other expats or transients? What was the group like?
So it was a mix. I mean, I probably would have gone to a meetup had I been living in Canada as well. I mean, I have gone to meetups since being here. I love meeting people in person. The meetup there was a mix. I mean, it was probably a bit heavier on the foreigner side of things. So, you know, as I said, it was run by Ruben, who was Dutch, and then I ended up being one of the organizers. There was, at the time I went, there were kind of like, I think, five main members. Another guy was from India, my friend Sankate, who now works on the research team at Blockstream, and then there was an Iranian guy, a guy from New Zealand, and then there were a few Koreans as well. Probably the most notable Korean who was attending while I was there was Calvin Kim, who now does research on U3XO with Tajdria. So it's a way to optimize syncing up a new node. It was a decent mix, I would say. And like, maybe part of it was I was, an expat living there and kind of wanted to meet other people. But I kind of do that thing anyways, even though I'm back in Canada.
Yeah. What did you think of Bitcoin at that time? It might be hard to recollect what you thought of it at that time as you were learning about it, but did you think it was a currency? Did you think it was sort of technology? Did you think it was going to be what it is today? Kind of, if you could reflect on where you were, what you thought about it at the time.
Yeah, I was pretty optimistic from it pretty early on. And, you know, is it money, is it technology? I mean, like all of the above, you know, I see all these people arguing about, like, is it technically a money? Is it technically a new asset? You know, I don't think that matters as much. Like, it all depends how you define these words. So let's just talk about how it works and, you know, like, whatever. You can call it a banana if you like. I don't care. I was pretty, like, pretty early on. I think it was, I read the white paper and then like didn't really get it at first. It took me a few read throughs over the course of like, I think a few weeks. And then I kind of went back and tried to learn how the existing monetary system works, which I'd never really bothered to do before. And then it kind of clicked. I was like, oh, this is a really interesting idea. And then I also just have an optimist bias. I'm generally optimistic about things in general. And so if I get interested in something, I'm going to be optimistic in it. So I didn't go through a phase where I was like super skeptical of it. At the same time, I've never gotten to that phase where I think it's going to fix all the world's problems. I've never kind of gotten that far either. I was also quite lucky in that I didn't go through any sort of altcoin phase and like lose a bunch of money on kind of random tokens. But the guys there were pretty, like, they weren't like hardcore, like you're not allowed to like these other things, but they, at the same time, when I kind of was like, oh, what about these other coins? They were like, well, you know, there's some of these problems with them. And they had pretty clear answers for me when I was wondering, you know, why, you know, Dash wasn't a good idea or NEM or whatever. And you know, then again, maybe I would have made a ton of money off Ethereum because when I joined, it was right. kind of worth $8 or something. But, you know, I kind of was set on my current course pretty early on. I didn't do a lot of meandering through the Bitcoin blockchain space. I think that's largely thanks to the solid group of dudes I met there.
That's huge. How did you end up at Blockstream?
So during I joined that meetup in 2016, and then by 2017 I was one of the organizers. And 2017, as you may recall, was kind of, that's cryptomania really took off, and especially in Korea. So we went from having like, you know, like 5, maybe 10 people show up to our meetups to like 40, 50, 60 people RSVPing. So we started doing presentations to bigger and bigger groups, and I started doing these as well. And that's a great way to learn more if you commit yourself to teaching it. And then in 2017 also, that was kind of the climax of the block size wars, you know, Bitcoin Cash split off. And then we had, you know, SegWit 2X was this other fork of Bitcoin that was being pushed through. And we took a pretty strong stance on it. We wrote one or maybe two articles we published on Medium that basically said, you know, hey, we're the sole Bitcoin meetup. We are kind of opposed to SegWit 2X. And we were the first kind of a sort of grassroots, like kind of just meetup group to take a stance on this. And after we did, a whole bunch of other groups in the days and weeks afterwards started a voice in their opinion. So it was kind of cool. We were like, hey, we started this like little wave. So that was our little claim to fame during the block size wars. And because of this, there was a brief period where a lot of people suddenly knew who this whole Bitcoin meetup was. And then the VP of solutions, Warren Togami from Blockstream, happened to be coming through Seoul soon after that and decided to swing by the meetup. And so we invited him to, you know, come give a talk. And so I got to spend an afternoon and evening with him. Like, you know, he met us in the cafe before and we got drinks afterwards. And so I mentioned to him, I said, hey, like, you know, I'm an English teacher, but I would love to get some, to find a job in the space. And I'd been learning coding for the last year, but I was still at a super amateur level. So I told him, you know, if you know of any companies that, you know, have any need for my skills, please let me know. And I wasn't like angling for a job at Blockstream just because I didn't think they would have any need for someone like me, because I just kind of assumed you have to be some like wizard coder, or, you know, biz dev genius for them to want you. So it wouldn't have occurred to me to apply to Blockstream, but Warren ended up recommending me for a job as a customer support lead, which I applied for in January 2018. And I ended up moving back to Canada, to Victoria, because that's where they wanted me. And I would have moved anywhere, basically. I was just really excited to be working in the industry. So I ended up working at Blockstream for 3 years because of that.
Can you tell us a little bit about what happens at Blockstream? I mean, they have a wallet, they satellites, Liquid, Bitcoin bonds.
The primary role I was hired for was mainly doing client support for the Blockstream Green wallet. So Blockstream Green is a fully open source Bitcoin and Liquid wallet, and it has this cool multi-sig security model, which is a little difficult to to grasp. Like, I mean, that's not fair. Like, I mean, basically there's two keys, one held by the user, one held by the Blockstream servers. But there's always a time lock clause that if anything fishy happens with Blockstream servers, you just wait for a certain amount of time and then you can claim the coins yourself. And so what this allows is for 2FA security without giving up the non-custodial nature. So it's a really cool wallet, actually. And then now you can also do single signature wallets with it. At the time I was working there, you could not. But yeah, they just needed someone who could do client support for this, which is interesting work in that it wasn't your typical customer support where, like, you know, someone has a problem and then you like verify their identity and like check their account. There was none of that because it was non-custodial. So I didn't know who the clients were. And so I kind of learned how to give support while kind of, it was almost like giving support to like Schrodinger's clients. I had to treat them as though they were both a client in need of help and someone who was a malicious attacker trying to get some access to someone else's funds. So which is an interesting challenge, you know. So I spent a lot of time interacting with the Blockstream Green devs. It's a team mainly based out of Milan. Those are great guys. I'm still in touch with a lot of them. And then as kind of bear market hit, there was less and less need for support there. So I started working a bit more closely with Samson Mo on the marketing team. So I was involved with the Blockstream store where we were selling. Originally it was just selling swag, but then later on kind of satellite kits and hardware devices. So that's what I was involved in. And I got to interact with a lot of different bits and pieces of the business as well. Blockstream is involved in a lot of different projects. So like the main flagship product is Liquid, which is a side chain for Bitcoin. So it's a separate blockchain where you can move your Bitcoins onto the side chain and move them around using a different set of rules. And then kind of you can unpeg or peg out your coins back to the Bitcoin blockchain. And then you can also do all sorts of things on like issue, you know, separate assets. And then you can interact with like, you know, Tether on Liquid in the same transactions as you're interacting with, you know, Liquid Bitcoin, for example. And then, you know, Blockstream is also, you know, does mining collocation and these like satellite nodes, a lot of projects actually. Yeah.
What was the mining project you just mentioned? The collocation?
This is actually a thing I was probably involved with the least, but I can tell you a bit about it. Blockstream just does a lot of their own mining and but also will host your miners for you. So Blockstream has negotiated a lot of power contracts in advance and has kind of built out centers. And so let's say you want to, you know, invest in Bitcoin mining, you can buy a bunch of miners and then rather having to go negotiate power contracts yourself and find a site and set it up yourself, you can buy a bunch of miners and then pay Blockstream to host them for you. So that's the collocation side of it. But I wasn't involved very heavily with that.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'd love to kind of get into Ledin now. And absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit about like who is Ledin and what services do you guys offer?
Sure. All right. Are we? So Ledin, we are a Canada-based Bitcoin company that offers basic financial services on Bitcoin and USDC. So our main two families of products are savings and loans. So savings accounts work very simply. You deposit your Bitcoin or USDC on our platform and we lend it out, which generates interest, and we pay you interest. So right now you can earn up to 6.25% on your Bitcoin and up to 9.5% on your USDC. We are recording this in November, so actually the rate may be changed by the time December hits, but it should be far off from there.
Sure.
And then we also do loans. So we do Bitcoin-backed loans where, let's say you have a chunk of Bitcoin and you need access to dollar liquidity and you don't want to sell your Bitcoin. Maybe you don't want to trigger taxable event. Maybe you don't want to miss out on some possible price rises. You can leave your Bitcoin with us and we will issue you a loan denominated in US dollars or USDC. And so we can send it to your bank account or send you USDC. And whenever you're ready, you pay back the loan and then we release your Bitcoin collateral right back to you. And because, you know, we're holding your Bitcoin as collateral, it's very liquid. It's very easy for us to move if, you know, if we do need to close the loan. It's very low risk on our end. And, you know, there's no credit checks or anything. So we're able to issue loans to a lot of people in a lot of jurisdictions that might not otherwise have access to that kind of liquidity. And then we also have B2X loans. So the easiest way to understand this is by understanding why we launched B2X loans. So Dollar Loans was the original, product. And we found that there were people coming to Ledin and were taking, putting up their Bitcoin as collateral, taking a loan in US dollars, and then buying more Bitcoin to get more exposure. And then taking that Bitcoin and posting it as collateral, and then, getting a loan based on half of that and then kind of cycling this. And so B2X essentially automates this process. If you want to finance your Bitcoin to get more Bitcoin exposure, you collateralize your Bitcoin with us and we'll issue you a loan at the full value of whatever you collateralize. So let's say you deposit $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, we'll give you a loan of $10,000 and we will automatically buy more Bitcoin for you and add that to your collateral. So it comes out because, you're automatically collateralizing the new Bitcoin you just purchased. It comes out to a 50% loan to value ratio as you would with a dollar loan. It just makes that whole process automated for you.
Yeah.
Those are our main products.
How does Ledin generate the interest that it pays on these loans?
Yeah. I'll start with the USDC because that's quite simple. As I noted, with our loans, our dollar loans, you collateralize Bitcoin with us and then we lend out dollars and we charge interest on that. So the way we provide liquidity, the way we get these dollars is from our USDC deposits. It's one of the sources for it. So if you deposit USDC with us, what we are doing is we're loaning that out to other Ledin clients who have collateralized Bitcoin with us. And we're able to earn slightly more than 9.5% based on the loans. And so that's why we can pass that on to users and savings. With our Bitcoin savings accounts, we primarily lend those out through Genesis Capital. They're our trading partner. So Genesis Capital is one of the oldest and I think the biggest lender in the in the cryptocurrency space. And they've been in operation for, I believe, coming up on 5 years now. They're highly transparent. They issue quarterly reports. You can go look them up yourself. They have very, very high standards for who they lend coins out to. But they are, I believe it's, if not most, it's all of the Bitcoin that we lend out is through Genesis. So we lend to them and then whatever yield we generate from them, we pass on to our clients in the form of interest.
Got it.
And by the way, so this episode is going to be released early December, you said, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we do have some other exciting news from Ledin at the moment as well. We are for December, we are doing a special, we're essentially supercharging our referral program at Ledin right now. So up until this month, you would get 10 USDC for referring a new client. Both the referrer and the newly referred client would each get 10 USDC once the new client has signed up and funds their account. We are upping that to $50, 50 USDC. So for the month of December only, if you refer a new client and they fund their account with the minimum balance, which is 75 USDC, you can look up the terms on our site. I can give you a link, actually. Maybe you can put that in the description. But that's for December only. So if you are interested in joining Ledin and you're listening to this, it's a great time to do that in the next couple weeks. And if you can refer a friend, if you sign up and through the Bitcoin Matrix link, actually, it should give you the $50 bonus. And then if you refer a friend as well, it's $100 right there. So it's a good time to jump on it.
Yeah. And can you get longer loans through Ledin?
So the
durations of the loans?
Yeah, sure. I can go into a bit more details about the terms. So I wish I had a glass of wine. Our loans are generally denominated for 1 year. But they are much more flexible than this seems. So when you take out a loan with Ledin, the terms are, you have a loan for 1 year. There's a 2% admin fee when you take out the loan. We charge 9.5% interest. And at the end of that year, you could extend it for another year if you want, just by paying 2% admin fee, or you can close it. The other thing you can do is you can close the loan at any time. You can just pay back the balance like after like 2.5 months, and then you will only pay 2.5 months worth of interest. Another kind of advantage is that we do not have any monthly interest payments that we require. The interest gradually accrues over time. So, and then you only need to make one single payment when you close the loan. You can do that whenever you want. You can do it at the end of the 1 year term or anytime before then, and you will only pay interest up until that point. If you get to the end of the year and your loan to value ratio is still healthy, you just let us know and we can extend it for another year. So even though technically they're for 1 year terms, they're highly, highly flexible.
Right. Yeah. So no prepayment penalties and highly flexible on the back end. What about if the Bitcoin price significantly increases or decreases?
If you take it out a loan and the Bitcoin price increases, you're sitting pretty. Nothing to worry about because essentially the collateral that you have becomes greater relative to the amount you owe. You do have to keep an eye on the Bitcoin price decreasing though. So our loans are taken out at 50% loan to value. The B2X loans, as I said, it's actually technically we issue you a loan at 100% loan to value, but the newly purchased Bitcoin is automatically added. So it becomes 50% right away. So 50% loan to value means that the amount we loan you is worth 50% of the collateral you put up. Now, the Bitcoin price crashes a bunch. Let's say it crashes, 10% or so. That means the amount of your collateral is worth 10% less. So that means the amount that you owe us on the loan is going to be higher than 50% loan to value. Now, you have to keep an eye on this. If it gets to 80% loan to value, we are forced to close the loan. We do close the loan by selling enough of your collateral to pay off the balance. And then whatever is left over from the collateral goes back to you, and you don't owe the dollar amount anymore. Of course, we don't want this to happen. We like our clients keeping their loans open as long as they want them to be. So we do send regular reminders. We're pretty active on social media, reminding people when the price goes down, hey, keep an eye on your LTV. We will email our clients at various thresholds. Like if your loan to value gets to 70%, we'll send you a message. Be like, hey, just so you know, you might want to top off here. Topping off your collateral is quite simple. So let's say the Bitcoin price goes down a bit and you're at 6% loan to value and you want to keep that at a healthier rate. You can either send new Bitcoin to us. So it's pretty simple. You'll log into the platform, hit top up, and you'll get a receiving address. And once the funds are received, it'll be added. Or if you have funds in our savings account where they're earning interest, you can very, very quickly move them over. And then you don't need to wait for an on-chain payment or anything. So that's what some clients will do is they'll come to us, they'll take out a loan. And then they'll also just leave some funds in their Bitcoin savings account and they can have that ready. That's essentially like more collateral they can move over really quickly when needed, but it also earns them interest in the meantime.
Yeah. And what type of information do we need to provide to open a loan? What I need to provide just kind of what information would I need to be a user of Ledin?
Yeah, we require like basic KYC. That's that regulation requires. So when you sign up and create an account, you will be asked to provide ID so we can know your name. We'll need a phone number, an email address, some form of ID, and your region of residence. Again, because the which products we can't offer are going to vary jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Although we do operate in I think over 127 countries, you have clients now. But that's it. That's the basic information. Once you have verified your identity on our account, we don't require additional information when you apply to take out a loan. Again, this is one of the advantages. Like Bitcoin is excellent collateral. It's very low risk on our part. This isn't like us collateralizing someone's car or home, which is in their possession. It means that we don't have to do extra snooping around. We don't have to, we don't have to deal with credit scores. It's great.
Yeah. And what, I'm kind of curious, what have been some of the users been like? Is it primarily Canadians? What is the international sort of makeup of your users like? What is the community like as, you're the director? What is the community like? What kind of questions do your users ask? Where are they predominantly located? What kind of gets them excited or what kind of gets them nervous? I'm not sure.
So, yeah, this is a great question. Our user base, as I said, is quite international, over 127 countries, but the vast majority are in the Americas. So we have a lot of Canadian and American clients, but we also have a heavy focus in Latin America. Our co-founder, Maurizio Di Bartolomeo, I believe he's been on your show before. He grew up in Venezuela and probably about half our team or close to it are bilingual. So we offer full services in English and Spanish and Portuguese. That's, the platform itself and our support team. And so we have a lot of clients also in places like Mexico and Venezuela, in Colombia, in Brazil, we're growing our client base. It's quite a dispersed group of clients. Again, we also have people, in Asia and Europe, et cetera. But yeah, it is, we are heavy, um, heavily focused in North and South America. And yeah, it was fun. I got to be in El Salvador a couple of weeks ago, and we got to meet a lot of our clients down there, which is really cool. You know, it's and people too tend to use our products differently based on different services. So, you know, clients from Canada are often more interested in savings accounts or the B2X loans, whereas clients in Mexico, for example, often will use the dollar loans a bit more. You know, one thing that was there was an event we did in Mexico a couple of months ago. I didn't go to this one, but my colleagues were telling me about it, and they were one of the surprises was a lot of our clients who came out to our event were entrepreneurs, people who kind of used us as financial services for their business, which was cool. You know, we're quite fortunate here in Canada. Like, if I want to get a loan, I can do that at a bank pretty easily, but there are a lot of places where that isn't as easy a thing to do.
Yeah. What have you learned maybe about Bitcoin while working at Ledin that you didn't know about Bitcoin before? Or what have maybe, how has Bitcoin maybe changed, or have you seen it change some of the users or their habits, or like from their questions, how have you seen them evolve?
Yeah, well, so the jumping from Blockstream to Ledin was really interesting because they're very, very different business models. Blockstream is heavy on open source tools, non-custodial tools, a lot of infrastructure layer products. You know, as I was saying before, the support there was very different because there was no KYC, right?
Right.
Whereas Ledin is a bit more of a traditional business model. It's, you know, you leave the coins with us on the platform, and we provide, you know, basic, well understood, you know, services like savings and products, and we do go through KYC. So, you know, I haven't been as involved in the customer support, the client support side of things in Ledin as much, but it has been interesting seeing the kind of the different sorts of, you know, concerns around security and privacy. It's very, very different models. You know, right. Security with Blockstream Green was all about like making sure that the code was well reviewed. It was open source. It was available. It did what it was supposed to. Privacy involved, you know, we don't want to collect information from our users. And when someone would come to me, I would often have to tell people, listen, don't tell me this information. I don't need that. Whereas with Ledin, you know, it's inherent in the business model. We need to collect a lot of this information. So a lot more of what I see has to do with like the security practices are quite different to that. You know, we're a lot stricter about who has access to what internally. Like, everything's on a very much a need to know basis. You know, the tools that we use to access our kind of, you know, our internal tools are locked down in a very different way. So that's been a really interesting, a separate, you know, different side of the Bitcoin world to view. One of the other big differences is that when I joined Blockstream, I was very, I had a lot of people who knew far, far more than I did about Bitcoin, had been in the space far longer than I did. And, you know, it's a company kind of a lot of Bitcoiners in it. Whereas Ledin is like, there's a handful of us Bitcoiners, but a lot of the employees are just, you know, we needed like a legal team, and right. We needed, you know, like, you know, people with kind of more specific skills, but not as, but it isn't as, there aren't as many native Bitcoiners as Blockstream, which is actually really fun for me because now I get to be someone who I spend a lot more time teaching other people internally at the Bitcoin, at the company about Bitcoin, which has been fun.
Yeah. I'm really interested. What about like maybe Bitcoin backed mortgages? Is that in the future? Is that in the roadmap? Is that sort of like a problem you guys are hatching away at?
Oh, yeah. I'm curious where this question came from.
I mean, I think there's a large demand for it. I will note, I mean, NVK tweeted something about it today, just in terms of like, you know, he's very excited about that notion and what that could do for, you know, sort of maybe the future bull run. I know that like Ledin is sort of looking at that a little bit, just, you know, from the last time I talked to Maurizio, and I was just curious.
Yeah, there's nothing I can comment on that yet, it's a very good question.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, definitely something that I think as a primarily maybe an American user, when I look at the Bitcoin financial services, I look at it more as pristine collateral, as we were kind of talking about. And I love all the services. I think, you know, when I look at the USDC services, I think primarily about people who are trying to, you know, fight off inflation and really looking about like sort of checkings account preservation. And that is a concern of mine. Maybe if I were to build up cash balances in the near term, trying to deal with volatility, I would probably rather, you know, and I do have some at Ledin, but I would rather be there than say at Bank of America. But I think this industry grows, and I think about sort of North American users who don't have sort of maybe hyperinflation to battle, I think it's the B2X programs, you know, double your Bitcoin and sort of ways of sort of, I think of it like secured personal loans where I don't have to put up my collateral and I could not have a tax transaction and, you know, take out money and then pay it back in fiat. So I think that's a really interesting area for Bitcoin financial services to explore, and it's really exciting.
I mean, I will definitely say that we are interested in expanding our product suite, and we are looking at different types of loans. So keep your eyes peeled, people.
Sure. What I really like to dig into as well, because I think you really have sort of a good purview on this and foundational sort of knowledge, is, you know, we just had Taproot. And it's the first major upgrade to Bitcoin in 4 years. You've been around for 5 years. So you've seen, you know, an upgrade before. You've kind of, it's interesting, we haven't talked about really markets yet and bull markets and those cycles. And I'm not really sure we'll get into that. But I would love to kind of get a little bit of knowledge here on Taproot. But I think to kind of backtrack a bit, maybe we could just start with UTXOs. And sure, what is a UTXO, and just build from there a little bit.
Yeah, that works. So when you are sending or receiving a Bitcoin transaction, what you're doing is you are simply, you're taking, each transaction is going to have one or more inputs and one or more outputs. And an input just points to a previous output in the Bitcoin chain. And it says, okay, we're taking the coins that were here and we're now saying they're here. And the output will, each output will have a set of spending conditions that will say, this is how these coins can get moved again. And each input is just fulfilling spending conditions from earlier outputs. So that's all, that's essentially all transaction is. There's a bit of extra data in there, but it's just taking some inputs, one or more inputs, and plugging them into one or more outputs. And a UTXO stands for an unspent transaction output. So that means an output that has not been spent yet. So if an output hasn't been spent, that means it's still under the control of whoever kind of knows the information how to spend it, which is usually, you know, having a private key, being able to produce a signature. So you might hear the term a UTXO set. So that's the list of all the unspent transaction outputs as of the most recent block. And that just means the UTXO set is just a complete list of who owns what coins, essentially. That's a one way to think of it. Yeah, so that's the basic idea.
Yeah.
So and yeah, what... I, like... Yeah, maybe I can give a better example as well. Sure. If you have a Bitcoin wallet and you see your balance in it, what that is in the background, the wallet, your wallet has a private key, and the private key gives it access to, you know, a whole bunch of different addresses. And your wallet will essentially scan the Bitcoin blockchain and find all of the outputs sent to an address that a private key can spend from. All of the unspent transaction outputs, all the UTXOs, and it adds them up, and then it gives you your wallet balance. So your wallet balance is, it's a bit misleading in some ways. Like, I mean, it's been adjusted because we're more used to dealing with these whole sums. But that wallet balance is just the total sum of all the UTXOs, all the unspent outputs that your wallet's private key can control.
Right. And in the event that we had a crazy software bug or some sort of happenstance, we could roll back to a certain point in time with a certain point of UTXO set, and we could go to another chain or sort of other workouts in that regard. That's just the UTXO set is just what we have in all the on-spend transactions, essentially, just basically a state in time.
Yeah. Like each as of each block, you're going to have a new UTXO set. So when a new block gets added, there are all these transactions. And if you're running a node, your node will look at each transaction and be like, okay, this output has been spent. And then we have these new outputs. And then so it'll adjust the UTXO set accordingly. And then you'll kind of know where all the Bitcoins are sitting.
Right. And, you know, the last major upgrade was SegWit. So can you tell us a little bit about what that did for Bitcoin and explain that a little bit?
Absolutely. So SegWit is short for segregated witness. And so what that means is it segregates the witness data from transactions. So as I said before, let's say you have a transaction and there's an input, which is, you know, if I'm sending a transaction, the input will be spending a UTXO that belonged to me. And the witness data is the data inside that input that that proves that I'm the person who's able to spend it. Usually that's a signature. Usually an output just says, you know, whoever could produce this signature, you know, can spend this. And then when there's a transaction that spends from that, the input will be like, hey, like, here's the, you know, signature, right? So the witness data is usually just digital signatures. Now, SegWit, what it did was it actually took the witness data, so these signatures, and it kept that data separately from the rest of the transaction. So there are kind of two chunks for transaction data. And so with SegWit transactions, if you have a block with SegWit transactions, for example, or transaction spending from SegWit inputs, you'll have you'll have all this information from the transactions, and then afterwards you'll have all the witness data for those SegWit inputs. And the reason this was important is it fixed several things, but one of the things it fixed was unintentional transaction malleability. So when you create a transaction, it's going to have a thing called a transaction ID, a transaction hash. And so you take all the data in a transaction and then you run it through a hash function, it'll have this unique fingerprint, this unique number that just belongs to that transaction. Now with the signatures that were used with, that are used on Bitcoin, at least up for Taproot and including Taproot, now there's an extra one, or ECDSA signatures. And these had a certain property where you could take someone's signature and you could adjust the data a little bit and it would still be a valid signature for the same piece of data, but it would be slightly different data. And so that would change the transaction ID. So this was a bit of a problem for certain things, like it made it harder to make Lightning Network channels and it made wallet software a bit more complicated. So by keeping the witness data separate, you create the transaction ID from all of the non-witness data, and it stops that from being able to be changed by someone else before the transaction gets confirmed. And there were a few other, you know, small benefits that came with SegWit, but that was the main one. So now with SegWit, like as a user, you don't really have to worry about this. This is just all taken care of in the background from, you know, your wallet software, whatever you're using to generate transactions. But it came with a lot of benefits. It made things a lot more efficient. It also was a block size increase because the witness data was then included in an extra part of the block, which allowed for more data to be added in. So it was a slight scaling improvement as well. And it also solved some other things, like there was this quadratic hash problem that kind of allowed for the creation of really large transactions. It would take a long time to validate. And this was a bit of a risk that someone could like, I'm not sure if spam the right network is the right call, but is the right way to phrase it. But yeah, there were a whole bunch of minor improvements. Actually, if you look up, there's just look up SegWit SegWit advantages or SegWit SegWit benefits. There are a few really, really well tailored lists on there, especially on the Bitcoin Core website.
Yeah, and then what is SegWit 2x then?
Right. So SegWit 2x was so back in 2016, 2017, there was a big rift in the community between whether or not we should increase the block size as a scaling solution and just continually make the block size bigger to allow Bitcoin to scale, or whether or not we should try to scale primarily through through different methods. The concern is that the bigger the blocks get, the harder it becomes to validate the Bitcoin network to run a node. And this is a centralization risk, because if that becomes more and more expensive, then a smaller and smaller number of people can validate the Bitcoin network. And if you end up in a position where only a small number of people can afford to do that, then they essentially control the currency and can make changes against your will, right? And so while this rift was going on, there was a group of companies decided they wanted to offer a compromise that essentially made like no one happy. But they said, okay, we're going to add SegWit and we're going to double the block size. That's where the 2x comes from.
Got it.
this kind of made the big blocker camp. Most of them just really didn't like SegWit, so they didn't like this. And most of us who supported SegWit, which supported a lot more of the kind of layer two scaling and already included the block size increase, really didn't like this kind of kludge. So kind of most people didn't like it. Yeah, a lot of the kind of big blockers had already left and were on with Bitcoin Cash. And anyway, so that's where the name came from. SegWit2x ended up, it never launched. It was essentially dead on arrival. I think it was a couple of weeks before it was supposed to launch that its proponents backed off and said, okay, like they admitted defeat. They acknowledged that they had not built sufficient consensus for it. So it never did launch. It was discovered later that that it actually had a few bugs in it that would have caused it to kind of never take off the runway anyways. That was, you know, no small part because it only really had one developer working on it. It didn't have proper review, which you really need for these things. It's been a while since I've explained that one. It's ancient history now, man. It was 4 years ago.
That's when I was getting started, and it was very confusing. It was very confused, especially as someone who's coming into it, and you know, you're learning all these terms and trying to figure out these things on the fly. And I think a lot of it obviously was an attack. I mean,
I want to give a shout out. If anyone listening to this wants to really understand this, look up the book The Block Size War by Jonathan Beer. It is an excellent book. In my opinion, the best book I know of about Bitcoin, and it kind of explains this whole kind of 2-3 year history of what happened, but it also introduces the technical concepts in a really, 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 really kind of digestible way. And the pacing is excellent, so you'll learn a lot about kind of Bitcoin, its ethos, and its technical properties. So definitely big shout out, Block Size War by Jonathan Beer. Go look it up.
Definitely. And so that takes us now, not directly to Taproot, but in terms of major upgrades, Taproot was activated about 2, maybe 3 weeks ago. What does that sort of upgrade enable in the system? What does that change for Bitcoin? Why is this so important?
Sure. All right. So Taproot and SegWit are both soft forks. They are updates to the Bitcoin consensus rules, to the consensus protocol, meaning that they affect the rules of what is or is not valid in a transaction. So Bitcoin Core is getting continuous updates over time, but most of them don't affect the consensus rules. So it's a bit easier to make updates because people can update at their own pace. With consensus rules, it's really important that enough of the community updates at the same time to avoid any chain splits. So this is why these happen less frequently, and they're a much bigger deal. Yeah, Taproot has been the first one since SegWit, so it's been 4 years. And Taproot, it allows for a new address type in Bitcoin. So it allows for a new type of address, a new type of output you can send your coins to that comes with a few benefits. So the first thing it does is it introduces a new signature type called Schnorr signatures. And these are similar in a lot of ways to ECDSA signatures, as I mentioned before, but they allow for more efficient aggregated signatures. That is, let's say you have a multi-sig, so an output that requires several signatures to spend from. Before Taproot, if you wanted to spend from that output, each party would need to produce a signature, and then you need to include all those signatures in the input in order to spend from that transaction. With Taproot, there's a way that the parties can actually take their signatures and provide a single signature that requires both of their data, and then just spend from this single address. So this is great for scaling and for privacy. This is great for scaling because now you only need the amount of data required for one signature. So there's just less data needs to be included in the transaction. That means more transactions can fit in a block, right? And it's good for privacy because what everyone else in the network sees is they just see a signal signature spending from this one address. So nobody knows if it was, you know, a multi-sig or a single signature transaction. It all looks the same. And this is really important. We say this is good for privacy and fungibility. You might hear this term a lot in Bitcoin. Fungibility just means different units are treated the same. So things that benefit privacy in Bitcoin benefit fungibility because if surveillance companies are able to distinguish different types of transactions and kind of, okay, this one came from this person, this one came from this company, the more data they can figure out there, the more there's a risk that different Bitcoins will be treated differently because they might have different histories. So the more that we can make Bitcoin private and make the job harder for these surveillance companies, the more Bitcoins can each be treated, you know, interchangeable with each other, and the better, and that's a very important property for money to have. So that's part of what Taproot does. Taproot also incorporates a thing called MAST, which allows you, which is really useful for basic smart contracts on Bitcoin. So when I say smart contracts, I mean, you know, multi-signature, but also time locks or hash locks and different combinations thereof. So some outputs will have multiple different possible spending conditions. So you could say, you know, this output can be spent by, you know, Alice and Bob, if they both produce their signature, or can be spent just by Alice and a time lock, you know, after a week has passed. Now, you know, you might wonder, like, in what situations are these useful? There's actually a big variety of them. The main one right now is Lightning Network. To open and close Lightning Network transactions requires, or to open and close Lightning Network channels requires these outputs with multiple spending conditions, right? So with Taproot, what you can do is you can separate these different spending conditions into different paths. And when you spend from one of them, you only have to reveal the path that you use. And so the rest of the network doesn't see what the other path was. And so again, we have a big boost to scaling and and privacy here, because there's just more data that never needs to hit the blockchain. And you don't get to see what that other data is. You only need to see the spending condition that was already, that was used. So yeah, again, just less data needs to be included in transactions is the main thing. So everything looks a little bit more similar, and we can fit more transactions of these types into blocks.
Right. And you mentioned the Schnorr signatures. Why wasn't Bitcoin using these from the beginning, from 2008, 2009?
Patents, essentially. So we knew about Schnorr signatures back then. They existed. We kind of knew they were secure, but there was a patent that had not expired yet. And so ECDSA were used from the start. But now we have Schnorr signatures, and actually there's a lot more we can do with Schnorr signatures as well, that will hopefully come in future soft forks. And this kind of, I think this lays a bit of the groundwork for that, Taproot does.
Awesome. And you mentioned consensus rules a lot. Does Bitcoin enable or bring us to consensus? Is that an accurate way to say it? Does it just, do we reach consensus in the Bitcoin network?
Okay, so consensus just means that that the participants agree on like the state of the network, for example. And there are certain things that everyone running a node needs to agree on, and certain things that they don't need to agree on. So when it comes to the blocks that are, you know, being added and the transactions in them, it's very important everyone agrees on them. If there's disagreement on which blocks are valid or invalid because there are different rule sets being adhered to, that means that Bitcoin can split into multiple chains. This is essentially what happened with Bitcoin Cash. They decided we're going to have our own nodes that are going to like operate on a different set of rules. And then they had their own blocks started getting created. They ended up being their own currency. So that's what I mean by consensus. Consensus just means agreement among participants, right?
Right.
So consensus code, essentially, it basically boils down to which blocks and the transactions in them, which ones are valid and are not valid. And if everyone agrees on what is valid, then we can be confident that consensus will be reached. Now, there are other things that nodes do that you don't need consensus on. So you may have heard of a mempool. So a mempool is kind of just a list of unconfirmed transactions that haven't been included in blocks yet. Those we don't need consensus on yet. So it doesn't matter if different nodes have slightly different transactions in their mempool, as long as everyone agrees on what ends up in the blocks anyways. So that's what I mean by consensus.
Right.
There's also people also use the word consensus in more of a kind of social layer. So we need broad consensus on like soft forks before trying to implement them. You know, if you don't have everybody agreeing on what updates we want to include on the Bitcoin network, then how to proceed is like, you know, becomes a lot tougher. We've seen, you know, what happened with the block size war referred to earlier, and the kind of splitting into multiple coins. So people also talk about consensus that layer, like how much the participants of the network kind of want to the same things or different things. And then there's consensus in the very technical sense of like, are nodes all enforcing the same rules?
Right. I'm really curious. What is your favorite part of Bitcoin?
Oh, geez. All right. Man, we switched gears there. I was in like technical explanation mode. What's my favorite part of Bitcoin? My favorite part of Bitcoin, I'm going to give two answers. One is I like just the relationships I've made with people in the space. Like I've made some just incredible friends and like kind of mentors and kind of teammates over the past 5 years. That's been a huge part of it for me. You know, the real Bitcoin was the friends we made along the way. For a less corny answer, I think just the fact that it's it involves a whole bunch of, it pulls from several different fields of study. So I kind of think of myself as a bit of a generalist. I like learning about a lot of different things, and Bitcoin's great for that because, you know, there's the monetary aspect, there's the cryptography part, there's the, you know, computer networks part, there's the social layer. You know, there's so much stuff around like how changes are communicated and discussed. And I like the fact that there's so much different stuff to learn. There's, you know, you're never going to run out of stuff to learn. It's out there. It's public. You can, you know, I'm so grateful that I found Bitcoin at the right time, met the right people, that even though I didn't have any sort of relevant background, you know, I had people who could teach me and resources out there that I could just start learning it. And there was no kind of credentialism or like, you don't have the right degree, you can't get involved. There was none of that. So I really love that part.
Yeah. Has Bitcoin changed you at all?
Has Bitcoin changed me? Yeah. I mean, like everything you do changes you. Every action you take will affect you in some way. Yeah, Bitcoin's had a huge impact on my life. I didn't have a career I was excited about before. You know, I had jobs that I did because, you know, they had pros and cons. They let me live a lifestyle and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Bitcoin has given me something I'm really, really excited to work on. And it was also like, I've written a thread about this a few years back. Maybe I can bump it to you. But before I found Bitcoin, I was actually going through a pretty rough period in my life. I kind of was aimless in a lot of ways. I didn't really have any constructive hobbies. And for me, you know, finding something that, that interested me in my mid-20s, like when I, you know, used to spend just a lot of my time, you know, drinking or playing video games and that kind of thing, and finding something that got me learning, like, you know, new skills and like talking to, you know, interacting with like really smart people. It's had a really great impact on my life. Yeah.
Awesome.
And, you know, no, number go up doesn't hurt either.
Right. I hear you. And what about longevity that's mentioned on your Twitter profile?
I forgot I added that. Longevity. Yeah. Okay. This is the first time I've been asked about this on a podcast, actually. I wasn't expecting that. I'm really interested in efforts to see if we can solve aging. I don't have a background in, you know, medicine or biology or anything, but I'm in the last couple of years I've been really interested in the prospect that aging might be a solvable problem, or we can you know, like already if you like, you know, watch like a movie from like 70 years ago and you look at the characters who are supposed to be in their 30s and they look like haggard, they look like they're in their 50s or something. You know, we've made a lot of gains just by like, you know, improvements to like medicine, like, you know, vaccines, getting people to stop drinking stop smoking as much. I don't know if drinking is increased or decreasing. You know, there's a few ways we've kind of backslid and the like obesity is on the rise, but overall people live healthier and they live longer. But there's also a kind of a growing belief that, the biological processes that kind of break down as we get older can be countered and stopped. And I've been really interested in kind of work done in that area.
How far along do you think we are? Do you think, you know, this is something we're going to see in our lifetimes, maybe our children's lifetimes, or is grandchildren's
hope so.
Lifetimes?
I would love to live for hundreds of thousands of years and like get to see where things go. That'd be great. But I have no idea. I really don't know. I've been very much a spectator in that arena. I do like that you're asking about it, and that I think it's something that people kind of just dismiss out of hand. It's just like we've kind of grown up thinking like, oh, like, you know, humans live for like, you know, 80 years, give or take a decade or two, and that's it. It's a fundamental fact of nature, and we never really question it. And I do want people to start questioning it, because there were a lot of things that people used to believe was impossible. Like, I mean, if you've flown on a plane, like try explaining to someone like, sure, 200 years ago that we could do that, it would be like, it's like magic to them. Right.
Yeah.
And so I have no confidence in timelines. I would love to live for an extremely extended amount of time, but I have no idea if I'm going to be able to. But I do hope more people view this as like a possibly solvable problem rather than just, you know, our current lifespans being inevitable.
Yeah, I haven't gone down the rabbit hole, but I would think it's solvable. I think it leads lends itself to a whole other slew of questions and problems, but I would think the benefits outweigh the problems. But, you know, what are you going to do with all that time? I'm sure some people would say there's going to be a competition of resources if people could live for very long periods of time.
Well, I mean, I don't really buy that because like
I don't buy that
our,
either.
But I do hear that critique a lot. But I mean, like our population has been increasing drastically for the last few hundred years, and our ability to produce resources has been increasing during that time. Like the average person lives a much more materially wealthy lifestyle now than 200 years ago, even though there's far more people. And you've also seen like birth rates are plummeting everywhere on Earth. We're kind of in for a bit of a demographic crisis. So like, remember that like if we can crack aging, also people, like if we can stop those processes from happening, people would get to live longer at a much healthier age and would probably be able to, you know, produce and like, you know, we'd have more scientists could keep doing research and like people would be able to take care of them. It's not like, you know, I think if you have a society where like, you know, people live forever, but they live forever in like a 90-year-old's body, then yeah, that's a bit of a problem. I don't see that as much of an issue for if we got to get to live young and healthy.
Yeah, I hear you. What about effective altruism? How does that come into play?
Effective altruism is a really cool, cluster of projects. It's kind of a group of overlapping communities and individuals who take the perspective that like people who want to do good, want to improve the world around them, in a really, really rigorous kind of analytical way. So I think it's easiest if I just describe a few of the projects involved. So one of them is GiveWell. So GiveWell analyzes charities and ranks them based on how effective they are. So they'll look into, you know, a bunch of charities on global health. And we'll try to figure out, like, you know, if you have a charity that's trying to solve some sort of disease and has these, like, you know, mediations, you know, or kind of treatments available, they will do their best to calculate, like, roughly how many lives can you save per dollar, right? And of course, these aren't perfect, but they can give you rough ideas. And they find that actually the most effective charities are far, far more effective than the average one. And so you can go to GiveWell and be like, let's say I'm interested in, you know, donating money to help with global health. They'll be like, boom, here are the top, like, you know, seven charities. We recommend you donate to them, probably not to the other ones, right? And you can do this for like different types of, you know, charities as well, like for, you know, education or, you know, stuff like, you know, just you can go to their website and see lots of different categories. So that's one of them. There's also like earning, the Giving Pledge, I believe it's called, or Giving What We Can. So it's kind of a pledge of people who say, okay, I'm going to donate 10% of my income to charities, for example. And it's just a way to try to get more people to donate to these ones. And it's not all about charities. So there's another one called 80,000 Hours, which helps people choose and then excel in really high impact careers. So let's say I am interested in choosing a career that I think is going to, you know, improve the well-being of other people. And maybe I'm interested in, say, medicine. You know, do I want to be a doctor or do I want to go into kind of research and, you know, for new, you know, types of treatments, for example. And, you know, if you were to go to GiveWell, they would have different arguments and articles and they might do a consultation with you. And they might kind of suggest like, well, maybe if you can like go into research for like a malaria vaccine, for example, if you can bring that, if your contribution can bring that to market like a month earlier, that might result in like, you know, tens of thousands of lives saved. Whereas if you're like, you know, a GP in Canada, you know, you're going to help people, but it's unlikely you're going to help like, you know, 10,000 save 10,000 lives over the course of your life. So they just help people make considerations like this. And they've been really cool. And they actually, they came on my radar before Bitcoin did. And they were the first kind of place where I kind of was looking at my different aptitudes and thinking, what should I do with myself, that recommended I work for an early stage startup of some kind, which at the time was like nowhere on my radar, but like several years later, that's what I ended up doing, which, so they kind of hold a special place in my heart. And then I think another good example is Open Philanthropy. So if anyone knows who Dustin Moskovitz, and I've forgotten his partner's name, but he was one of the early Facebook, employees. Yeah, and made a considerable amount of money and decided he wanted to use it as effectively as he could and give it all away before he died. And so Open Philanthropy is similar to GiveWell in some ways, except it's more for people who have larger chunks of money to give away. So like some charity might do really effective with the first like $100,000 you give them. And then beyond there, they might have like picked all the low hanging fruits that are like less effective. You know, you can't just like throw $1 billion at one charity. Right. Like, right. You know, they're going to hit diminishing returns of that. So open philanthropy is more for kind of bigger projects and kind of long shot ideas. So they might fund startups where like, it's more of like a VC focus in that like you fund like 10 projects and maybe 9 of them will fail, but one of them might have a huge impact. And people don't often think that way in terms of charitable giving or kind of altruistic goals, but it's really important that some people do because there's probably a lot of value to be had there.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm really curious on that note, if you could give, you know, your prior self or someone in their mid-20s advice, what do you think you'd give them? What would be your advice?
Oh, this is always such a hard question because like advice is really context specific, right? You know, so advice that might be really good for one person might not be great for someone else. If I'm looking back to myself in my early 20s, I guess just like some of the good decisions I made, I wish I would have made them earlier. You know, like cutting back on alcohol, going to therapy was really important for me. I was going through a pretty dark time, my mid-20s, and I think had I gone to therapy like a year or two earlier, I might have pulled myself out of that earlier. Trying psychedelics earlier, that they've had a tremendously positive impact on my life, and I really only got into them when I was about 28, and so you know, but at the same time, like I don't want to give that as like, if you're considering it, look into it. Yeah, it's not for everyone, might not be for you if you're listening. They're definitely worth considering. I think they're underrated, although that's rapidly changing. I think it's becoming quite understood that there's value there. Yeah. But those are the kind of the big things that have, other than, you know, the Bitcoin side of things, those are the kind of big kind of changes for me that I kind of wish I'd made earlier. Sure. But yeah, it's your mileage may vary.
I hear you. And then my final question is what maybe is the most optimistic thing that you think Bitcoin's going to do for the world, or what can Bitcoin do for the world, or what is it doing for the world? Maybe it's doing it already, but
that's a tough one. The potential to bring digital money to the vast swaths of the world that don't yet have access to that because of, you know, lack of infrastructure or corrupt institutions or shady governments. The fact that Bitcoin can just break through that and be, you know, geopolitically neutral, that's huge. That right there is I think like just such a massive win. I think there are a lot of valid critiques of Bitcoin, but the people who kind of pretend that that's a big nothing burger, I just don't have the patience for that. Like, Alex Gladstein does a great job of articulating this. Of identifying places where people are really kind of screwed by their, by kind of authoritarian regimes and are kind of, kept unbanked, or places where, women aren't allowed to, you know, hold their own accounts and stuff. And the fact that Bitcoin just, you know, blasts right through that, or at least has the potential to, I think that keeps me going.
Yeah, I mean, Bitcoin is for everyone, and it's quite wild. Now everyone can have access to a tool that most didn't have access to before, and what it can do for humanity is really incredible. Mario, this has been so dope. I really appreciate our time together. I want to thank you so much for coming on. Can you let people know where they could find you and all the services at Ledin?
Yeah, absolutely. Lend's easy to look up. Go to lend.io, L-E-D-N.io. No. Follow Bitcoin Matrix's custom link, right? That should be you should have access to that. Find us there. If you want to hear more from me, I am on Twitter, Mario_Gibney. And you can also check out my own podcast, The Unhashed Podcast, for some technical deep dives and R-rated banter. But yeah, thanks so much for having me on. This has been super fun.
This has been so dope. Thank you so much, Mario.
Mario Gibney on his rabbit hole story, his early days at Blockstream, using BTC as the pristine collateral that it is, and the benefits of the Taproot upgrade right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And this episode was brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Ledin is the first digital asset lender with the transparency and security of a formal proof of reserves attestation, raising the bar in the space. To open your account and get $50 free in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan, make sure to head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Also, prices for the Bitcoin 2022 conference will continue to go up, so buy your tickets today and make sure to use the code Bitcoin Matrix for 10% off at checkout. And thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, rate, and review so you don't miss out on any upcoming fresh and dope episodes. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused. This is Cedric. Peace.